favorite portion there. You know, there's several sermons in the Scriptures, and this is one of them. Paul, and I think it stands head and shoulders above other of his speeches. And it's about the city of Athens. Now, this morning what we're looking at, really, taking from Acts chapter 17, is that we want to discuss the unknown God. Now, you find that in Acts chapter 17 and verse 23. But now, before we get to that, a little background on the city of Athens. The city of Athens of the first century was, well, it considered itself as the intellectual center of the world. Athens was home to a number of notable figures, such as Pericles, who's believed to be the father of the basic tenets of democracy, Socrates, Plato, and a number of others. Aristotle was educated in Plato's academy in Athens. The rest of the known world acknowledged the position of Athens in its worldly might and sophistication. Athens had a tremendous impact on civilization and was what was then the Western world. This impact that Athens had has gone down through many generations, even down to our present day, some of the things that were taught, believed, etc. at Athens. Now, when it came to religion, though, Athens was very much a polytheistic city. They worshipped many gods. Idols were in abundance, and every building there was dedicated to one god or another. Now, the account in Acts says that Athens was either given over or full of idols, however your translation might read. And believe it or not, that's actually an understatement. One contemporary commentator says that Athens was a city drowning in idolatry. Pliny, who was a first century historian, writes that Athens had 30,000 public statues and countless others in private homes. A tremendous number of these statues, now not all of them, but a tremendous number of them were actually idols. It wouldn't be uncommon for a home to have perhaps a dozen in it. Petronius, who was a first century author, sneeringly said that it was easier to find a god than a man in Athens. And yet, for all the rampant idolatry in Athens, there was the acknowledgement of an unknown God. Acts chapter 17 and verse 23. I had an image I was going to show, but it's not actually from Athens, but it was an altar that was found in Italy, and it's got written on it, you know, to an unknown God. So it wasn't just Athens that practiced this kind of thing. It was practiced in a number of places. And I would dare say that God was unknown in a lot of places. And the fact that they had an altar there to an unknown God, which would indicate that they acknowledged a God that they did not know, well, that actually says, you know, they were right by accident. They did not know the God of the Bible. They might have known every other god, known in man's imagination and devices, but the God of the Bible, no, they didn't know that. The true God was unknown to them, and what Paul was going to do was to make him known to them. So, of course, it was a great and stinging lesson. Don't misunderstand that. They would feel the sting of his words when he would begin to tell them, for all of your sophistication and for all of your intellectualism and everything that everybody says about Athens, what everybody thinks about themselves in Athens, you got this wrong. Here's something you don't know. They would much like that. So it was a great lesson. And I think it's an equally valuable lesson in this. for the 21st century world, and for our country, for the religions of today, and yes, even for the church. You know, there are millions who are very satisfied that they are very religious, like those in Athens in Acts chapter 17, verse 22. It's always been kind of a curiosity to me the number of times I have seen the United States described as a Christian nation. I think that's still going to go on no matter what or who or whatever happens. And yet I have always thought to myself, just exactly when was this a Christian nation? When is this? When was it where the people who ruled in this country ruled by what was said in the Bible? When was this? Now, I understand that there were probably been times when people have been a whole lot closer to following what was said in the Bible than they are today. I understand that. But when was it that this was actually the case in practice? I don't know. I've not been able to find it. And I don't know how that's going to work because it's a democracy. We're a democracy. And in a democracy, boil it all down to simple language, it's the will of the people that is supposed to be met and served, not the will of God. I don't know, but anyway. There are lots of people, though, that think that we are and that we're very religious, and yet they actually do not know God. So we're going to consider that today. And the first thing for us to do is just to look at the problem of religious ignorance. Now, the problem there in Athens, and it's the same problem in the 21st century, at the root of the problem is materialism. And now today, it's not just basic materialism. In other words, everybody's out for all that they can get, and they just live for that. And God is things and jobs and other things, you know, that whole idea. No, not just basic materialism, but a radical materialism. Now, radical materialism is a combination of things. It's got it's atheism, but it's rooted in evolution and ordinary materialism. It shuts God completely out of the picture, all the way back to the beginning of mankind. God's out. And don't think for a moment that there aren't people who are atheists. They're not just atheists, you know, means that no God. That's basically what it means. There are atheists that are anti-theists. It's not just no God, it's anti-God. They want God stamped out. That's the atheist on steroids, if you will. So you've got this kind of thing going on, and it goes all the way back, and that's what they're trying to do. It's an attempt to eliminate God. And somehow or another, they think that they're being very successful in this. And when you do this, what's left? Now, just think about it. What's left? Well, what's left is that man relies upon himself in such a scheme. That's all that's left. It's just us. We've all heard about humanism. You know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, that's all I heard when I was first a member of the church there. You had gospel meetings. There would be a lesson on humanism at some point in it, and you thought about humanism, and I read in some of the Brotherhood papers all about humanism, so on and so on. And after a while, sorting through all of this, getting the basic gist of it, the God of humanism is man. In the whole scheme of humanism, I'm a God, and that's all I need. Or you are, or whoever is. And so that's what we've got today. And here's another thing. Now I want you to think about this for just a few moments and see if this isn't true. You know, we talk about our national pastime. When I was a little boy, that was baseball. It was the most popular sport going. Well, it's kind of fallen from popularity. And now I guess it would be football. that's our national pastime, you know, sports-wise, we might say. But now when we think about a national pastime, how about this? Leaving God out has nearly become our national pastime. And there's efforts made to leave God out of more and more and more and more. And we just can't have this. We can't have it. We can't have a prayer before a ball game. We can't have, you know, when I was a kid, the speaker at the graduation services was always one of the ministers in town. Can't have that anymore. And we've come to this idea of the separation of church and state means that, well, we're going to leave God out completely. And that's become our national pastime. And I think, you know, we would just be foolish to think that that's not what's going on. And that's really not what the case is. Turn to Jeremiah chapter 9. Now, behind all this is man glorying in his wisdom. In Jeremiah chapter 9, starting in verse 23, thus says the Lord. Now, thus says the Lord. Now, every time you see that, you know, in the Old Testament, you want to, well, let's pay close attention. Let not a wise man boast of his wisdom, and let not the mighty man boast of his might. Let not a rich man boast of his riches. But let him who boasts of this, that he understands and knows me, that I am the Lord who exercises loving kindness, justice, and righteousness on earth, for I delight in these things, declares the Lord. Well, it sounds to me like way back there in Jeremiah's time, they had a problem with this business here in verse 23, don't you think? Is there a problem with that today? Yes. And what people need to learn back there in those days, well, now, if you've got wisdom or might or riches or any of those kinds of things, it's because of the magnanimous generosity of God. And the same thing would be true today. But we don't hear a lot about it. We hear a lot about how wise I am and how mighty I am and how powerful I am and how rich I am and so on it goes. I think we find a like passage to that of Jeremiah in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and in verse 21. For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. Well, it says about the same thing, didn't it? The man glories in his wisdom. But now when man is glorying in his wisdom, back in Jeremiah's day, or in the first century, or in the 21st century, when you're glorying in your wisdom, you know what it is? It's almost an admission that, well, you did not come to know God. You don't really, he's unknown to you. Because you're spending all of your time admiring yourself. Our country's religions, plural, however you want to parse that out. If you want to say it's denominations, if you want to say it's all of the major religions of the world like Hinduism and Muslims and Catholicism and whatever, however you want to parse that out. The country's religions have accepted a polytheistic slant. We have. There's very few that haven't done that. All you've got to do is drive along someplace and perhaps you'll see a billboard. Or maybe you'll hear something on the radio or something on the television. Or perhaps you'll pick up a newspaper. Our newspaper back home, Martha gets it every week. You can go over there to where the religious section is at and there's all the churches on there. They've got all their times. They got whoever the preacher there. They got their name there. They got everything all listed down there. Then at the bottom or at the top, someplace on that page, it will say, worship at the church of your choice. How different is that from worship the God of your choice? Well, basically, it isn't that different. And I'll tell you what, even in some of what's called Protestantism, and some of the things that you hear, you've got to begin to wonder, are they worshiping the same God? But then it doesn't matter. Because, you see, we've adopted this polytheistic slant ourselves. So we look over here to Athens and we think, oh, look at those folks over there. Hundreds of idols, hundreds of gods are being worshipped over there in Athens. Why? What a bunch of... And whatever. And we're different in this country. Really? Are we now? It's a God that's worshipped, though, most generally, is a God that fits this idea of materialism. Now, back in the Old Testament, and Isaiah chapter 44, that's where we're going to go this time. Isaiah chapter 44, verses 14 through 17. I think this is very interesting here. And it talks about idolatry. It starts back about verse 9. Well, it starts at the beginning of the chapter, but it really starts to heat up when you get to verse 9. When you get to verse 14, it's talking about a man who goes out and cuts cedars for himself. Nothing wrong with that. And he takes a cypress or an oak and he raises it up for himself among the trees of the forest. Now we've got a problem. He plants a fir and the rain makes it grow. Now watch. Then it becomes something. It becomes something for a man to burn. So he takes of them. And look what he does. He warms himself, builds a fire, doesn't he? It's working for him. Yeah, all right. And then what else does he do with this? Well, he makes a fire and he bakes bread. Okay. And what else does he do? Out of this tree, he also makes a god and worships it. Why? Because, it's provided for me. Materially, it's kept me warm and it's made my bread, and so I'll just make an idol and I'll just worship it. I'll show my appreciation for this tree, whatever it is. He makes it a graven image and he falls down before it. Half of it he burns in the fire. Over this half he eats meat as he roasts a roast and is satisfied. He also warms himself and says, aha, I am warm, I have seen the fire. But the rest of it he makes into a god, his graven image. He falls down before it and worships. He also prays to it and says, delivered me, for you are my God. A God that fits materialism. If there are people today who want a God, they'll take any God as long as it fits materialism. If it's a God that provides for material things, then I'll be happy, I'll bow down, and I'll worship whatever it is. Have things changed all that much? No. You know, and here's the thing. It can be any God as long as it is the God of your choice. That's the main facet. See, which goes along with this polytheistic slant in our country. And then we have those who are just so bold as to suggest that the God of the Bible ought to be altered to fit man's desire. And so what do we have? Well, we want God and we see Him as a kindly grandfather type. He's beloved, you know, but largely He's irrelevant. Grandpa's over there in the rocking chair and he's got some things to say and some stories to tell. We just don't pay a whole lot of attention to it. Well, that's kind of God. See? Or they want a God who's kind of like a cosmic bellhop. If you're unfamiliar with a bellhop, that was somebody who worked in a hotel, and that was a person that you gave orders to, and boy, they just went right after it real quick like. So that's how they want God. They want God. Well, we can just kind of order Him around. Or they want a God that's a universal Santa Claus, jolly and happy with everything that we do. And just ready to just dispense gifts without any end and without any limitations or qualifications. And then there's also the God of my cause. And that's probably more prevalent anymore than anything else. What do you mean by the God of my cause? Well, it could be the issue du jour. So he becomes the God of global warming or the God of homelessness. Or the God of gay rights. And just whatever the issue is. Why, they find that God's all behind this. And we want it that way, and we appreciate it that. And somebody says, well, you know, he's really not into those kinds of things, and you're some kind of, I don't know what. Well, you're just not, you just don't believe in God at all, or something along that line. The God of my understanding. Well, how I understand God, in other words, how I think He ought to be, that's how He's going to be. And people that are out here kind of looking around, you know, and they're testing out this religion and that religion and the other, what are they looking for? You think that they're out there looking for truth? Are they out there looking for a God, or maybe even a church or a preacher, whatever the case is, that kind of fits what I think how it ought to be? And how you think it ought to be, is that based on what the Scriptures say? Most of the time, no, it's not. Truth doesn't enter into the picture. It's I think. And I want a God that thinks and says and does as I think it ought to be done. Which kind of dovetails into this other thing, my experience. I was watching something on TV. I have no idea what the show was. But somebody was interviewing Vince Gill, country music singer. I'm pretty sure that's what he is. Anyway, they were interviewing him. And they asked him a question about there being one God. And his reply was, well, I've been lots of places and I've seen lots of things, and I just don't think that there's just one God. And the answer that he gave was absolutely phenomenal for its ignorance of God. What does going lots of places and seeing lots of things have anything to do with it? It's not got anything to do with it. Your experience doesn't have anything. But see, we've gone through all this business, and especially in this country, where somebody's experience counts more than anything else that you can think of. And well, it means this to me. And so, and there we go. And well, whatever it means, well, we're all just kind of locked in on what your experience is, what you've seen, what you've heard, where you've been, and we're all, and God's just locked in on that. Is that how it works? Why, how many gods would we have if that was the case? Well, we'd go right back to the idea of being a polytheistic religion. The God of my comfort. I want a God that makes things good, easy for me. And not just in this life, but in the next. I want a God where I can do whatever I want here, and there'll be nothing come of it. And I can still go to heaven. A God of my success. Well, the God that I'm looking for is one that's not only the God of my success, He ensures my success. In any or all of these, it's easy to see that God has been marginalized. You know, when something's marginalized, it's like, here it is in the text. You know, this happens in your Bibles, by the way. And there's a word in there, and they take it out of the text, and they put it over in the margin. In other words, they set it aside. God's been marginalized. He's been set aside in favor of some other kind of God. Now, behind all this, and willingly, I need to add, there's been a wholesale substitution in teaching. Perhaps people are ignorant due to a change of message. Think that might be it? Maybe people don't know God because, well, they're not hearing a whole lot about it. How many places are there in this country, in this state today, where a sermon will be delivered and you're not going to hear much about God? Well, probably a lot of them. And why is that? Why has there been a change of message? Because there's been more of a focusing on marketing strategies. You know, that's become a big deal. Rick Warren and the Saddleback Church out in California It's been one of the fastest growing churches in the last, I don't know, 30 years. And by the way, they'll never tell you this, but it's really affiliated with the Southern Baptist Convention. Never tell you that. He'll never tell you that he's an ordained Southern Baptist priest. He'll never do that. But anyway, how they got their start. You know how they got their start? They didn't start out with 4,000 or 5,000 people one day. You know, one day there's nothing here. Next day, you know, they own 6 or 7 acres of ground. They got 6,000 people. They didn't start that way. It started out, they did a survey. They went around the neighborhoods in California. They knocked on doors. And they asked people, what kind of a church would you like that you'd attend this church? What would you like? And so they did that for several days. Had a whole team of people doing that. Then they got back and they took all the data that they'd got from all these people. And then they looked it all over and they decided, now here's what the majority of these people would like in a church. One that they would attend. So we'll give them one. And so what they do? They come up with a church that fits the will of the people. That's the marketing strategy. Right? How's anybody successful in business? You give people what they want. It's been going on like that 200 years. And here it is in religion. His book, The Purpose-Driven Church, I think it's misnamed. It should be the market-driven church, because that's exactly what it is. That's what goes on. But anyway, it's the marketing strategies. How we can get more people, more this, more that, more the other, and according to the will, No, we'll put in a coffee bar, we'll put in volleyball courts, and you know, we'll have speakers up there, so the people that are sitting there at the coffee bar and out there at the volleyball court, why, the sermon that's being preached inside, they can hear it out there, and the kids can hear it over here at the playground. You get the picture? We'll give everybody what they want. They may hear lessons on psychology rather than the gospel. They won't call it psychology, but basically that's what you're going to hear. And here's one of my favorites. They're going to hear messages, they're going to hear something that warms the heart. And so there are going to be stories that are told about this person or that person or certain events or anything like that. And now I'm not opposed to something that might, you know, warm the heart, might make us feel a little better. I'm not opposed to that. I'm just opposed to that being all of it. And that's all you ever hear. And some places, that's it. There's a place online. I can go there. I don't go there very much, but you can go over there and there's all these sermons and they come from all these different places, everything you can imagine. And you can click on one and you can read, and it's just one story right after another. Well, as opposed to all of that, there ought to be a tendency to remain with the basics. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. And verse 7. This is a passage, I think, that we're familiar with. We're familiar with the first part of it, where it says, we have this treasure in earthen vessels. But now watch now. It's that way. So that the surpassing greatness of the power will be of God and not from ourselves. Well, that's kind of different from what we see going on. The power it's in you. You know, it's all about that. One of the most popular preachers on television today. It's all about you. Not about God. Well, the power is not in me. The power is in God. You and I would have to rely upon the power of God. And if we have any power of ourselves, it's because God has put that power in us. And that power has come through the power of the gospel. That's where it's at. But now here's another thing. And I found this surprising. Another member and I were looking at this passage in Titus chapter 1 and verse 16. I know I'd seen this passage before, but in putting this lesson together, I was directed over here and I thought to myself, wow, I just can't believe what this says. So look at Titus chapter 1, verse 16. They profess to know God, but by their deeds they deny Him, being detestable and disobedient and worthless for any good deed. They profess to know God. How many people are there that you know today that profess to know God? How many people do you see on TV that will stand up there and say, I'm a Christian? But now, what's the next part of it? By their deeds, they deny Him. I'm a Christian. Just don't pay any attention to the life that I live. But I'm a Christian. And what's this saying here? Well, they say they know Him, but well, they're really denying Him. And as a result of this, because, you know, they talk the talk and they don't walk the walk, they become this. They become detestable, disobedient. They're worthless for any good deed. Well, they're not doing any. It's just lip service. And very little else. And woe unto us if we were to come that way. The work of the gospel. The work of the gospel is to save souls. Not any of that other stuff that we've already looked at. It's to save souls. Jesus said, I didn't come to save the righteous. I came to save sinners. Matthew chapter 9, verse 13. Mark chapter 16. I should have 15 up there and 16. You go out into the world and you preach psychology. No. You go out into the world and use this marketing strategy. No. You go out into the world and you warm everybody's heart. No. You go out into the world and you preach the gospel. And if you preach the gospel, you know what? People will know God. Romans chapter 1, verse 16 and 17. We know those passages, don't we? Probably know the first one. I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, the power of God and salvation to all who believe, the Jew first and also to the Greek. And then what does it say in 17? For in it, in that gospel, is the righteousness of God revealed. And if you're not paying attention to the gospel, how are you going to know anything about the righteousness of God? See? But in it is the righteousness of God revealed, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. Well, there we go. And so it's the gospel is to save souls. And I mean to tell you, we just get away from that. We get involved in this, and I am in churches of Christ. You know, I've seen this in my lifetime, and it's all about our school. The church has got a school. The church has got a daycare center, and that's the big thing, the daycare center. And it's all about our programs. Now, if it's all about our programs, and then whenever it comes to the hour of worship, and What's going to come out of the pulpit? It's going to be about promoting our programs and everything else. And what about saving souls? Oh, well, yeah, we do. We do some of that too. Yeah. Yeah. And you see this. You see this in Lorain County, in Cuyahoga County. It's going on right here among us. It goes on in lots of places. Sometimes we just don't realize. God's just kind of shoved aside. And even our programs shove God out of the picture. Ephesians chapter 4. Let's look there real quick. Ephesians chapter 4, verses 11 through 16 describe the work of the gospel, the work of the church, really everything. It says here that He gave some as apostles and some as prophets and some as evangelists and some as pastors and teachers. Now why? Well, for the equipping of the saints, for the building up of the saints, for the work of service, to the building up of the body of Christ, until we all attain to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God. You see that there? Of the knowledge of the Son of God. To a mature man, to the measure of the stature which belongs to the fullness of Christ. As a result, we are no longer to be children, tossed here and there by waves and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men, by craftiness and deceitful scheming, and by all the gods that are presented in the world today. We could add that there and not miss a beat. But he says, speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in all aspects unto Him who is the head, even Christ, from whom the whole body, being fitted and held together by which every joint supplies according to the proper working of each individual part, causes the growth of the body for the building up of itself in love. We live in a society that's left God out. We've become so individualistic that everybody's become more or less a God in themselves, do whatever they want, just become, you know, free agents in all this. And yet at the end of this, we find out that every joint's got a part, and every joint needs to be there, and every joint supplies something. And this idea, oh, I can just be a free agent. I can just kind of just run off here and do whatever I want to do and believe whatever I want to be. And whatever that matter is, it's not found anywhere in the Scriptures, but it's found out here in the world. And it's found out here in these churches in the world. And I think sometimes it's even found amongst us. I know it is found among us sometimes. We've got to this tendency of not being the close-knit group and being together and being of one mind and one purpose and all having one goal, into having several minds and several goals and several purposes, and we find that there's no cohesiveness. And we're the worst for it. While the world applauds this and thinks it's wonderful, I've got an idea that God doesn't so approve. But then the world doesn't know this because, you know what? They don't know God. How about out here in the world? Do you think they've ever heard of these passages, 11 through 16, Ephesians 4? If you were to go out here to some place, to somebody who's out here in one of these churches that's just given over completely to this radical materialism, and you read those passages to them, you know, would the reaction be, and say that they've actually got a Bible with them, and they're reading along with you, and when you get done reading that, and they look at all that, and they look up and say, is that really in there? Yeah, you just read it. Or I just read it to you. Which reminds me, I had a lady one time, I was trying to convince her that baptism had something to do with salvation. So I went to 1 Peter 3:21. And I quoted it. And I said, the like figure whereunto baptism doth also now save us. That King James, that's what I've got memorized. And she said, it doesn't say that. And I said, well, here, look. And I offered her my Bible. Well, she wouldn't take my Bible. I had a trick Bible, you know. And I said, well, there's yours there on the table. You know, take it and read it. So she picked it up and said, read it aloud. See how I did, you know. And she read it and she got, the like figure whereunto baptism doth also now. And she stopped. Closed it up, had it right like this, and she said, I don't care what it says, I'm not going to believe it. I don't guess you will. If you can see it in there and still won't believe it? Do I think that she was just this unique person and the only one ever? No. No, there's others, aren't there? And here we go. Paul's solution. You know, Paul's solution to the problem in Athens is explained to us up there in chapter 22 through 31. I'm not going to go over every single thing here, but just kind of hit the highlights of this. Now, what he first does is he starts to discuss the ignorance of pagan worship. And so in 22 and 23, he stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, men of Athens, I observe that you are very religious in all respects. Now, very religious, it's been, sometimes it's translated as superstitious. Now, one commentator, I kind of liked what he had to say, he said, it means that you're diligently devoted to deities. Yeah, that works, because that's exactly what a city full of idols. Yeah. So when he says very religious, that's not a compliment. But he's just stating a fact. Oh boy, you know, you've got plenty of them. And he says, while I was passing through and examining the objects of your... I wasn't examining you personally. I was examining the objects of your worship. I also found an altar with this inscription to an unknown God. Therefore, what you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you. Well, he's going to discuss the ignorance of pagan worship, right? Pagan worship, does that go on in our country? Yeah, it does. We've already discussed a lot of the ways that this happens. Now, he proceeds from this to verse 24, excuse me. I need to read that too. The God who made the world and all things in it, since He is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. Can we grasp this? That God doesn't dwell in temples made with hands? Can we grasp that God doesn't just dwell in this building? Can we understand that? Are we going to box God in? Oh, I get out of this building. I get out of that temple. I get out of this building. Boy, I'm a free agent. I think sometimes maybe people do get that idea. But, of course, it would be erroneous, wouldn't it? Now, the one Creator God, that's the object of worship. He goes on to say, nor is He served by human hands as though He needed anything, since He Himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. Now, God doesn't need anything. We need it. You know, when you and I come together like this and worship God, the worshiping God, He's the object of our worship. But He's going to get by just fine when that happens. And He's going to get by just fine if it doesn't happen. But the worship that we render to Him, to the object of our worship, that's for us. That's for you and me. We're the benefactors of this when we worship God. And so if we think, well, it's all just for God's benefit and He needs that and He needs us. No, we're the ones that need to worship Him. And once again, I think sometimes that point just eludes us. Now, there's also mentioned here in 26 through 28 about God's relationship with mankind. This differs. Now, the gods that these people worship, they had no relationship. The only thing they were interested in people, humans, these gods, whoever it was, from Zeus on down, they were interested in how they could use these people, these humans, to get ahead and to get something they wanted. So we were just kind of, humans were just kind of something that they could have fun with, entertain themselves, or use human beings as a tool. That's about it. There was no personal involvement and relationship with humanity. But it says here in 26 through 28, He made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, that they would seek God, that perhaps they might grope for Him and find Him, though He is not far from each one of us. Now that's kind of a play on words for them to realize, you know, if you go home and the house is dark and there's a light switch over here, and what do? Well, you can't see it because it's dark. So what do you start doing this. It's right there. It's close. I can find it real easy. Real easy. Well, that's what He's telling them. This unknown God, you could find Him real easy. And the problem is, you're not looking. And there's no initiative to look. Well, and that happens in religion today. Sure does. Verse 28, for in Him we live and move and exist, as even some of your own poets have said, for we are also His children. And that's a Greek poet that particular expression is taken from. And so they wouldn't argue against that. And then what do you find? Well, in verse 29, he really comes home with this, and they have to once again hear this, where he says, being then the children of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and thought of man. And it's not your job, and it's not your home, and it's not your possessions, and it's not your country, and it's not whoever the president is, or your senator, your mayor, or your college professor, and so on it goes. You get the picture. Not something that's been formed or picked out by man. And then the conclusion, as all good things, it ought to have a conclusion to it, shouldn't it? And the conclusion is that, well, it's time to end this ignorance. Very good. And if there's ignorance in religion today and an unknown God, it's time to end this ignorance. Therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, overlooked it, but God is now, in other words, He's not overlooking it anymore, declaring to men that all people everywhere should repent, because He has fixed a day in which He will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom He has appointed, having furnished proof to all men by raising Him from the dead. Now you can see how well this was taken. The majority of people mocked Him and made fun of Him, but there were some that did believe and were grateful for that. We should always be grateful for that. There are always some who believe. Take your songbooks, turn to the songs been selected. We should do our very best to believe in the God of the Bible and to follow His will. Now, what that means is that we should do whatever is necessary to become a Christian and then be a Christian. In other words, live by faith. And then realize that we each have a responsibility to tell others about God's love and about His Son and the gospel. They may not ever know unless we would tell someone. Is there one here today that would become a child of God? We'd be happy to assist you in your obedience. If you do believe in Jesus Christ, the Son of God, and you repented of your sins, would be willing to confess Him before men and be baptized this very hour, we'd be happy to assist you. If you've fallen by the wayside, very easy to fall into the thinking of the world and forget about God, not know God. If you realize that this is what you've done, you find yourself in error, we'd be happy to pray with you and for you. Whatever the case might be, if you're subject, why don't you come all together? We stand and sing.